Welcome to the K-12 Breakdown with Brooks and Bronder, your daily podcast of the top education headlines from across the web. And now, here are your hosts, Mike and Susie.
Good morning and welcome to the K-12 Breakdown with Brooks and Bronder. Thanks again to Carl Hooker for that great introduction that makes us sound so much cooler than we are. We have some great stories today with rising rents. Some school districts are going to try to find teachers affordable housing. We're going to focus on the happenings in Houston ISD and the evaluations of principals, up to 80% of principals in Houston. We're going to talk about the class of COVID and Florida's Don't Say Gay settlement. Today is Pi Day, and we're very happy to be here celebrating with you. Hey, Susie, did you know that my math teacher in high school had a snake in the classroom?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, it was a python.
Oh, I didn't see that one coming at all.
What's on your desk this morning, Susie?
Oh, well, let's see. The Missouri Senate is to boost public school funding and private school tax credit bill. That's coming at us from Annalise Hanshaw from the 74. The Missouri Senate Democrats ended their filibuster Tuesday on a bill that seeks to expand the state's K-12 tax credit scholarship program, agreeing to let the legislation come to a vote after Republicans added provisions boosting the public school funding and the teacher retention efforts. Also, we have from the district administration, written by Monica Simmons, the 4 steps schools can take to ensure academic growth for all, while students with learning disabilities and English language learners often have interventions targeted to their individual needs. It's not uncommon for schools to take a one-size-fits-all approach to academic growth and instruction. And let's see, we also have Delta 8, an unregulated form of THC is popular among high school students. This is coming from Wisconsin Public Radio and shared through district administration as well. A national survey of more than 2,000 high school seniors across the country found that more than 11% use psychoactive compound, often called diet weed or weed light, in the last year. So if you want to check that out, you can head over to K12Leaders/breakdown. And now I'm going to head into a story that is coming from us from USA Today today. I've been dying to say that. So we have a story coming out. It's a long one. It's written by Claire Thornton. And so we have a summary for you. And it is about the... Sorry, lost my place again. I'm getting better at this, but certainly far from perfect. And this one is about the rising costs, how some school districts are trying to find teacher affordable housing. So, clicking on my tabs. Across the country, teachers are struggling to make ends meet due to rising housing costs and stagnant salaries. For many educators, finding an affordable place to live has become an immense challenge, leading some school districts to take an unusual step, building housing specifically for their teachers and staff. Take the case of Kareem Wall, a 31-year-old English teacher in Kansas City, Missouri. Last school year, Wall found himself homeless after being evicted just 2 days after his first year on the job. With his first paycheck still a month away and no money left over from the summer, Wall was forced to bounce between his classroom couch, his car, friends' couches, and the occasional hotel room for 7 grueling months. There were times when I felt irritable, delirious, extremely fatigued, Wall told USA Today. I felt like my body was one step behind. Wall's situation highlights the dire housing affordability crisis facing many teachers across the United States. According to the National Education Association, the average starting salary for teachers in recent years was just above $40,000. Meanwhile, recent economic data shows that starting teachers would have to spend more than 30% of their salary on rent, the definition of unaffordable housing, in more than 1 out of every 5 of the country's largest metro areas. These financial pressures have led to nearly 90% of public schools to struggle filling teaching positions for this school year, according to the National Center of Education Statistics. In response, some districts are taking matters into their own hands by building affordable housing units specifically for their employees. The Jefferson Union High School District in Daly City, California, opened an employee apartment building in 2022 with 122 units. Since teachers moved in, the district has started the 2022-23 and 2023-24 school years with zero vacancies for the first time in years. Our staff housing had a huge impact on that, said Austin Warden, the district's director of communications and staff housing. In Kansas City, a nonprofit called Teachers Like Me built a duplex where Wall now rents a one-bedroom unit for just $400 a month, a steal compared to the city's average rent of around $1,200. I feel like I've stumbled upon Kansas City's best-kept secret, Wall said of his new home. But while teacher housing has proven to be an effective retention strategy, it's not a perfect solution. These housing units are often limited in number with lengthy wait lists. And if a teacher loses their job, they also lose their affordable housing. When districts have to spend time and money and human resources to solve the housing problem of their teacher workforce, it takes them away from their core responsibility, said Heather Pesky, president of the National Council on Teacher Quality. Education advocates argue that while helpful, affordable housing shouldn't be a band-aid solution, teachers simply need higher salaries that keep up with the rising costs of living. Some districts, like Kansas City, have implemented raises recently, but researchers say that additional income is often still not enough to make housing truly affordable. As the teacher housing crisis persists, many hope for broader systemic changes to improve educator compensation and tackle the lack of affordable housing impacting communities nationwide. And so those sources are USA Today article and the National Education Association Data National Center for Education Statistics. And we all know that finding housing that's affordable is tough in any sense. But yes, for those on those starting teacher salaries, it's super tough. Michael, what are you seeing coming across your screen this morning?
Sure thing, Susie. Thanks for going in depth on that. Again, a real common issue that we come across a lot here on The Breakdown is teacher pay and housing. Let's see, from the New York Times this morning in the Learning Network, there are a couple of resources on writing open letters. We mentioned this yesterday in terms of who would you write an open letter to? And today they have lessons on a guide to writing open letters. And so that's something to check out on the Learning Network at the New York Times. And you can find that link on k12leaders.com/breakdown. NPR is going into some of the bans that California is considering, in this case on Flamin' Hot Cheetos. Under a proposal in the state legislature, public schools across California would no longer be allowed to serve foods that contain certain substances, including some artificial dyes commonly found in snacks. I have not gone into depth in this article, but I bet they're not talking about high fructose corn syrup. Let's see, there's some more great resources from the Learning Network at the New York Times. And let's see, of course, it's Pi Day, as I mentioned earlier. Tech and Learning has some resources available. You can find a link to their resources on k12leaders.com/breakdown. And let's take a dive into the class of COVID. This was originally reported on let's see, Minnesota Public Radio. It has been 4 years. This is originally based on Minnesota Public Radio's story by Elizabeth Shockman. It's been 4 years since Minnesota schools first shut down due to the COVID-19 pandemic. On March 15th, 2020, Governor Tom Walz ordered schools to temporarily close with just 35 confirmed cases in the state. Students like eighth grader Raylene McVicker were initially excited for some bonus time off. We were all like, yeah, we get an extra break, Ray said. We were so excited to have like a few extra days to be out of school. Yay, we get to completely play hooky. but that temporary break turned into the rest of the school year as cases surged. For students like Ray and her classmate, Allie Meyer, it meant being thrust into a high school experience turned upside down, with remote learning, canceled activities, and prolonged isolation. Ray struggled with distance learning. "I have to be in a classroom to be able to learn things," she said. "I was failing my classes really badly. COVID really threw a curveball in my education." Allie was able to keep her grades up, but found herself depressed from hours spent online. "I spent a lot of time online. I definitely didn't enjoy sitting on my phone for hours during the day, but you know, I still had to be logged on to my computer for my class period, even if I wasn't learning anything." The pandemic's impact on student mental health was severe. A 2022 statewide survey found nearly a third of Minnesota students struggled with long-term mental health issues. Amarin Chamberlain, now at Venture Academy in Minneapolis, described distance learning as a nightmare that led to poor habits. When schools reopened for in-person learning, the transition wasn't easy. Ray and Allie noticed classmates seeming withdrawn. "COVID took away a lot of physical and social exercise for our whole grade," Allie said. "Coming back, people don't have the same emotional stamina." I'll just point out, this is a high schooler talking about emotional stamina. Susie, I know that when we were in high school, that was never a word.
No, it certainly wasn't.
Definitely not a concept. Test scores plummeted and chronic absenteeism skyrocketed over 70% in the 21-22 school year. TJ Valtierra of Little Earth Boys and Girls Club said, "Overall, we've seen a lot of struggle. There are groups of kids that are still not really recovered." Despite the challenges, some students persevered. Kelly Bonet of Academy of Holy Angels pushed herself, motivated by her immigrant parents who hadn't finished high school. "I just felt like if I didn't go through, if I let myself get distracted easily by just being home, I was sort of gonna disappoint them," she said. For Ray and Allie in Red Wing, internship programs reinvigorated their passion for learning after feeling stuck in a repetitive cycle. "The key word for these last 4 years has just been recovery," Allie said. "I had to teach myself how to do hard things and how to focus again." As the class of 2024 nears graduation, their resilience shines through a turbulent era. As Aisha Abdullah from Minneapolis South said, "It's definitely always going to stick with me, but I think I managed okay. And my high school experience was still pretty good. I'm still happy about what happened." So that was Minnesota Public Radio. The article is "Students Persevere After COVID Disrupted in Minnesota High Schools." And the original author of that story we summarized was Elizabeth Shockman.
That's a great share.
Yep, thank you. And you can find that on k12leaders.com/breakdown.
Thank you. That's awesome, Mike. We have a couple more. These are actually all student-centered, and they're pretty much right in a row in our breakdown today. We have one from the 74, and it is Louisiana Teen's Stroke Detecting Invention is recognized in a national STEM contest. We have a New Orleans 14-year-old has a creation called Wing It, which measures heartbeat and nerve impulses to pick up early signs of stroke. So you can check that out. It's written by Sierra Lyons. And then we have another one from the 74, and it talks about a fourth grader explaining how March 14th, which is Pi Day, and the Dress for STEM campaign to celebrate women and National Potato Chip Day. So there's a few videos on that page that you can access through K12Leaders/breakdown. They're super cute. What's not cute about a fourth grader to begin with? And then on eSchool News, written by David Ball, there's an article, "Student Mental Health is Still Suffering and How Should We Address It?" So I'm going to jump in on a summary that we have on an article that was posted originally in the Houston Chronicle by Kennedy Sessions. And it is about some concerns that are coming out of the Houston ISD. So this is a summary because it's a pretty hefty article that you can read in its entirety later if you wish. Some Houston ISD parents are expressing frustration and concern about the future of their schools after Superintendent Mike Miles notified hundreds of principals that they must improve or risk losing their jobs. Tim Siniak, and I apologize if I don't have that right, Siniak, a parent with two children at Love Elementary in the Heights area, said he isn't sure if they will stay at HISD depending on how the rest of the year goes. Love Elementary is currently rated B+ and has seen a revolving door of five principals in the last 5 years. The school recently held community meetings to decide whether to join Miles' new education system reform plan of overhauled curricula and increased testing. After parents voiced concerns, former principal Sean Tellez declined to join NES, that new education system. Weeks later, he resigned, the same day that the Houston Chronicle reported that 117 principals had been notified that they were performing below proficient levels and could lose their jobs if they didn't improve. For Siniak, this showed a disconnect between the district's messaging and actions. It's disruptive and completely against the fact that the district claims everything is in the best interest of the children, he said. What Principal Tellez was bringing was stability that we have been craving. The performance notices from Miles went to newly assigned principals and veterans. His email said that they were making good progress, but needed to focus on high-quality instruction. The list of principals named sparked controversy, and some popular leaders of top schools included. Parent Tracy Lysqui said, "The whole community is frustrated. You don't really know what to be frustrated with anymore. I worry about principal and teacher retention. A recent survey showed over 40% of HISD teachers said they would not return next year, though the district disputes this. Miles stands by the evaluations, saying, I will not compromise on that. I expect every educator to continuously improve instruction with no exceptions. If we compromise, we will fail students, and that is not an option. Principal ratings from unsatisfactory to exemplary will determine compensation, with the highest rated principals eligible for nearly $200,000 and lower rated close to $130,000. Miles added, this is what raising expectations looks like. It asks a lot of people, makes some educators uncomfortable. That is expected and necessary. Some will not perform at the lower level, at the level our students need and decide to work elsewhere. But 97% of our teachers have said that they want to keep working in the district next year. As uncertainty looms, parents hope for stability amidst the district's reform pushes." So a very interesting read out of Houston, Texas. And you can check that out by visiting k12leaders.com/breakdown.
Thank you, Susie. That echoes a lot of conversations I've had this week. It's nice to see that that story is getting a little bit of coverage. Obviously, a complex issue for any superintendent. How do you manage performance within a organization like a K-12 school district?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. We have again. Here's a story from the 74. A fourth grader explains why Thursdays. You just touched on that one, Susie. Excuse me.
That's okay.
But about dress for STEM and Pi Day. So that's available on the 74 and k12leaders.com/breakdown. Student mental health is still suffering post-COVID, and how should we address it? David Ball from eSchool News goes into depth on that story. According to the CDC, more than one in three high school students experienced poor mental health during the pandemic. But in reality, the rate of U.S. students struggling with these challenges was rising even before COVID. You can find that on k12leaders.com/breakdown. And Kevin Hogan from eSchool News reflects on the Parkland tragedy, its lasting impacts, and work still to be done. And that was 6 years ago, the Parkland tragedy. Susie, I don't know if you recall, we talked about a book a year or two back called Why Meadow Died.
Yes.
And really interesting perspective, really hard to read for a number of reasons. But We still have everybody in Parkland clearly in our thoughts, and continue to process that along with the rest of the learning community.
That's for sure.
Let's see, we have an education next, how not to assess the situation. That's by Adam Tyner. And grading and testing have gone astray, but eliminating student performance measures is the wrong prescription. And we've had a number of stories over the last couple of weeks, from various folks across the educational spectrum, saying that standardized testing has a very strong role to play in education. And let's see, I think that the next story that I'm going to dive into here, Susie, is out of Florida. And so Florida students, teachers can say gay. Schools can't discriminate. This is by Beth Hawkins on the 74, and we'll do a readout of this here on this important topic. So attorneys representing a group of Florida students, parents, and teachers have settled a lawsuit challenging the state's prohibition on classroom instruction involving LGBTQ people and topics. While lessons specifically about sexual orientation and gender identity are still banned, the agreement will allow in-school classroom discussions of such topics, require schools to prohibit discrimination and bullying based on sexual orientation and gender identity, and make it clear that the so-called Don't Say Gay law does not extend to the banning of books. Further, the agreement stipulates that instruction must be neutral on LGBTQ matters, meaning, for example, that lessons cannot depict heterosexuality as preferable. The state of Florida has now made it clear that LGBTQ plus kids, parents, and teachers in Florida can in fact say that they are gay, the lead plaintiff's attorney, Roberta Kaplan, said in a statement. In addition to representing the Florida plaintiffs, Kaplan represented Edie Windsor, whose case resulted in the U.S. Supreme Court's landmark decision overturning the Defense of Marriage Act. More recently, she handled E. Jean Carroll's defamation lawsuit against former President Donald Trump. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis also declared the settlement a major win, noting that his Parental Rights in Education Act remains in effect. The law originally prohibited LGBTQ-related instruction in kindergarten through the third grade. Last year, it was amended to outlaw most lessons in all grades. Because the law and related state regulations were broad and vague, school administrators have removed pride flags and stickers from classrooms, made teachers empty bookshelves, and done little to quell LGBTQ parents' fears that their children may be punished for talking about their families. If you read the early drafts of the Florida bill, it seems as if any discussion at all was prohibited, said Katie Blankenship, director of the state's chapter of the free speech advocacy group PEN America. Teachers were told never to discuss it in school if their families had same-sex partners. Go back to the closet, stay in the closet, or find another place to work. Florida Board of Education issued a rule saying teachers could lose their licenses if they violated restrictions on instruction, even though the law did not include such sanctions, or if classrooms contained books with LGBTQ characters or themes. In January 2023, the Williams Institute, an LGBTQ data clearinghouse located at UCLA, published survey results showing that almost 9 in 10 queer parents feared the law's impact on their families, with more than half considering leaving the state and a fourth reporting that they had been harassed since its passage. Under this week's agreement, education officials must send every school board in the state a copy of the settlement, which outlines numerous ways in which in-school discussions of LGBTQ topics is allowed, as well as officials' legal obligations to protect students and educators from harassment and discrimination. The document defines classroom instruction as the formal work of teaching and lists teaching an overview of modern gender theory or a particular view of marriage equality as an example of something prohibited, not banned, is mere discussion of gay or transgender people or same-sex couples in class, or a student's decision to address sexual orientation or gender identity. The statute would also leave teachers free to respond if students discuss their identities or family life. provide grades and feedback if a student chooses LGBTQ identity as an essay topic and answer questions about their families. The agreement states, it adds that just as no one would suggest that references to numbers in a history book constitute instruction on mathematics, a literary reference to LGBTQ people in a book does not violate the law any more than a math problem asking students to add bushels of apples is instruction on apple farming. Blankenship says she expects compliance will be uneven for some time. I anticipate different levels of eagerness to apply this settlement depending on the demographics of each community, she says. School leaders in some places will be delighted, while in some places it will be a struggle. The settlement does not apply to what Penn calls educational gag orders in other states, nor will it necessarily have an impact on increasing levels of teacher self-censorship that researchers have found, even in states where no law or rule limits what can be taught. Following the Florida law's 2022 passage, legislators in numerous states introduced bills restricting classroom speech. At least 15 states enacted versions of the law, and hundreds of anti-LGBTQ bills are under consideration in state houses in the current legislative season. While the letter of each law may differ, gay and transgender advocacy groups say the overall impact nationwide has been a marked increase in... I'm going to start that again. While the letter of each law may differ, gay and transgender advocacy groups say the overall impact nationwide has been a marked increase in in-school anti-LGBTQ violence and harassment, fear and confusion leading to teacher self-censorship, and the end of supportive programs such as gay-straight alliances. The U.S. Department of Education has launched an investigation into the death of non-binary Oklahoma teen Nex Benedict after a fight in a high school girls' bathroom. An LGBTQ educator in that district had been singled out for criticism by state officials for his support of queer youth. 2022 Oklahoma law forced Nex to use the girls' bathroom, a space considered unsafe for transgender youth. Data from the school climate advocacy group GLSEN and the Trevor Project reveals rising rates of anti-LGBTQ speech and actions not just in states where the new laws are in effect, but in classrooms in places previously known for supporting gay and trans students. Referring to the settlement as a very drinkable lemonade, Blankenship says it's a start. The bubble of fear has now been popped. So we've read a number of stories about on this topic over the last week or so here on The Breakdown. In particular, we've touched on Nex Benedict's death in Oklahoma. So we'll leave that one for you here on k12leaders.com/breakdown. You can find the link to the original article by Beth Hawkins on the 74 here.
Thanks for sharing that one. You're right. As much as they seem like they're all separate, they're certainly all related and intertwined. There's a lot of eyes on what's happening in Florida, and we know quite a few educators that are working there, and they've been sharing a lot of what their thoughts and feelings are on what the law has been and now how it's changing. So very interesting. And I think that wraps up another episode of the K-12 Breakdown with Brooks and Bronder. Remember, folks, starting a new podcast is like a multiple choice test. Sometimes you're not sure of the answer, but you just got to pick C and hope for the best. And speaking of circles, let's raise our calculators high in honor of Pi Day, because whether it's 3.14 or 22 divided by 7, math is the slice of life that keeps us all connected. Until tomorrow, I'm Susie Brooks and
I'm Mike Bronder.
Thanks for joining us. Have a great day at school.